and welcome to Vivian Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Hello, hello, and welcome to our spooktastic programming for the month of October. That's right, Horrifying Classics 2020. Today's horrifying classic is The October Country by Ray Bradbury. We read Something Wicked This Way Comes for our first ever horrifying classic series a few years ago, so Bradbury is back by popular demand, this time with a book of chilling short stories. We will be going through the book chronologically as well, not through every story, but through a good many of them, so let me know in the comments about what you think was intentional about the ordering of this collection. I always love engaging with you guys there. Author's introduction. History of the publication. Before we get too far into the weeds, my sources, as always, are linked in the show notes at relevanceofliterature.com/notes for your reference. I read the audiobook version of this book honestly for fun because I thought that since this book is such a staple of the American Gothic tradition, what other book would I enjoy in the audiobook format more than something by Ray Bradbury? I had no expectations and very little prior knowledge about this book before opening it, but the author's introduction was pretty startling to me because it's an autobiographical look into Bradbury's childhood, career, and earliest works, of course written by the author himself. This is the only part of the book that I really feel I cannot give proper justice to, so I would highly, highly recommend giving the introduction by Ray Bradbury a look or a listen to yourself, but when I finished the introduction, I needed answers because it's a bizarre and rare look at a writer's perception of themselves and of their past. So I went digging, and the most performative of the stories I found regarding this aspect of the text was an article by the Paris Review's Sam Weller titled "Where the Hills Are Fog and the Rivers Are Mist," which chronicles the history, reception, and miracle of this book, The October Country. As it turns out, The October Country is mostly a rewrite of Bradbury's first book of fiction, Dark Carnival, which, though lasting to the American Gothic tradition, had a very limited print run and thus remains a literary ghost to this day. In revisiting Dark Carnival for The October Country, Bradbury was able to do what he did obsessively, which was revision. Indeed, for the new book, Bradbury, quote, cut 12 tales altogether and added 4 new ones to round out the collection, unquote. A short from the collection that the Paris Review article takes special note of is a story called Homecoming, which is about a young boy who has trouble fitting in a family of talented vampires. It's a story about adolescence and family, much in tune with what Bradbury would later come to be known for, but behind this excellent piece is a story that I can't help but share. Quote, in late 1945 or early 1946, Bradbury submitted the story to Mademoiselle on a gamble. The story landed in the magazine's slush pile, where it eventually caught the eye of a reader in the office, another young writer who was also coming into his own, named Truman Capote, unquote. Long story short, the whole magazine ended up doing a Halloween theme based on their decision to publish Homecoming. And aside from the two books, Dark Carnival and this novel, the only other piece of American Gothic literature that Bradbury really published was the book that helped start horrifying classics, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Genre and past works. The Dwarf. This short is about a carnival proprietor and his girlfriend looking in on a dwarf who comes to the Hall of Mirrors every day to dance around and jump about when he reaches a specific point in the maze. The girlfriend becomes fascinated by the dwarf after the proprietor plays a dirty trick on him and finds out that the dwarf is a writer, and a wonderful one at that. This is the first short story in the whole novel of short stories. It's a very quiet one, it's a very peaceable one, and I really enjoyed it just for that quality. There's sort of a quiet hum that goes throughout this short story. It's definitely not as intense, for example, as some of the later ones, like the next one we'll get into. The setting is also very similar to the ending of Something Wicked with the carnival scene and the proprietor vibes, but we don't have characters like the Illustrated Man, for example. These are all very normal characters. I also love how he starts with a writer. A lot of this book is about autobiographically assigning things to Bradbury. I'm not gonna get too far into the weeds with this particular short story and that aspect, but I love how the focus is on a writer who ends up writing a short story about murder. There's also really amazing, well done, tactfully done, tastefully done omission in Bradbury's descriptions of the mirrors and what the dwarf and others look like in the mirrors that really allows your imagination to kick in. It's absolutely reminiscent of his other writing, especially in Something Wicked. His writing in some parts of the description is very bare, sort of like McCarthy or Hemingway, but of course in his own American kind of style. A lot of his story is also dialogue, and it focuses on the wonder and the mystery of this person and his writing, and this woman's fascination with him, things that she can find out and things that still remain unknown. And we will see the book also ends with a writer. Again, I think this really ties into a lot of the autobiographical nature of these stories, which really sets this book and Dark Carnival apart from Bradbury's others. The next in line. Man and wife are on vacation outside the US in a town known for its mummies. The wife gets a bad feeling about the mummies and the town after seeing an infant's funeral procession and tries to convince her husband to leave the town with her, to no avail. They visit the mummies the next day, the husband laughing with the guide and taking photos of the dead, and the wife counting the mummies in shocked silence. When the wife finally does convince her husband to pack up and go, the car won't start and they're stranded in the town for days. The wife becomes very ill and tries to make her husband promise her that she won't end up with the mummies when she dies. Well, this short was really surprising to me when I read it, or rather heard it on the audiobook. It really does have a specific and pointed diversion from his other books that I've read because of its psychological horror vibes and how much the intensity of the feelings are pointed out in the wife in the story about her caginess and her feeling just really stuck and feeling like she's going to die but having no alternative route besides staying in the town. Maybe this is with the exception of Fahrenheit 451 to an extent, but I really don't think that novel gets into the psychological nature and the ramifications of these decisions as much as this short does. There's a really simple plotline here, there's a lot of vagaries in it, but there's a wonderful suspense that builds into it. Malcolm Gladwell defines suspense as the writer playing with the reader's expectations around time. I think this is the best description of suspense I've ever heard, and this is truly something that Bradbury writes into a lot of these short stories. It is really a staple of the American Gothic tradition as well, if you've read a lot of those kinds of books in this genre. It's a suspense that I felt at the end of Something Wicked when everything is, you know, happening and there's the storms and the dad gets, you know, caught up in the library, all of that. That episode is linked down below, of course, by the way, at relevanceofliterature.com/notes. But in this story, I really felt like I expected the couple to move on and to go quicker and for things to resolve. But they just kept being unresolved, page after page, minute after minute. And it ends in this tragic event where you realize, oh my gosh, there's something quite wrong with a husband and why is he doing this? So I felt like there was just this Spannung, like this anticipation the whole time. Skeleton. We begin in a traditional doctor's office with a man whose bones ache. The doctor, as per usual in this man's life at least, says that he's a hypochondriac and to go away, so the man does. To M. Yunyen, a non-traditional skeleton doctor who can't help the man until, quote, he's ready, unquote. Over the coming weeks, the man starts having a war with his skeleton, starts losing weight so that the skeleton protrudes, reaching out of him, starts seeing the pain as a fight for self. Through this, the man's wife is supportive and wants to help, but remains somewhat distant until she sees a small man crunching on a skeleton on her walk home from the Red Cross, and she comes home to find a husband puddle. So in this short story and the last one, there's a huge focus on relationships that is not unlike Something Wicked, although in Something Wicked we have children that we're dealing with, so there is some stuff with, you know, relationship building between the children and the father, for example, and the father finally deciding to help and to go to the library and finally believing the kids in many respects. But in this one, it's about the man and wife, and of course in the last one as well, the relationship, the eroding relationship, might I add, between these couples. In the previous short story, of course, it's the wife who's having the difficulties and she's not feeling heard in the relationship. It's the same with the husband here, where he says, look, I'm battling my skeleton is trying to jump out of me, and the wife is going, this is not normal, let's try to repress this, let's try to ignore this. And this is a book much about 50s ideals, and I think it's very American pastoral in that way. It's very idyllic, but I love the way that he plays with gender roles in order to build hysteria in different ways. The wife in the last story gets lost in these magazines that she's finding all over the place. It's not America, right? So she has hard times finding American newspapers or magazines to read, and she's just stuck in the hotel room thinking, I'm gonna die, and I need to just distract myself from that. So she does the same thing, but her constraints are different. In this story, the husband is going to work, he is taking trips to Phoenix and doing business trips and all of this, and he's using his work as a means of escape because he knows that there's something, there's some tension building between his skeleton and his self and the rest of his body. But he tries to distract himself with the means he can. And those two different situations build the psychological trauma and horror, the suspense that we're experiencing in such different but really vivid ways. And I also love the psychological bend with the doctor at the end of this story, Skeleton. You're not really sure what the doctor is gonna do with him until the wife sees him on the street, just munching down on this guy's skeleton. And I thought that was just such a weird and wonderful way to end this really amazingly long build-up. Themes. The Small Assassin. A woman gives birth to a killer, but only she knows it. The baby tried to kill her at birth and is waiting, watching all the time to make its next move. The husband is concerned, he wants a loving family, and his wife hates their baby, until the baby makes an assassination attempt on him by leaving tripping objects near the stairs. Then the baby actually kills his wife using the same method, and thereafter succeeds in killing the husband, his father, by turning on the gas in the house while he's sleeping. What for, you may ask? Well, what's more traumatizing than being ripped from the womb? I really went back and forth of should I include this story, should I not, should I include it or not. This was the most chilling story for me by far, just because of the shock value of it. There's a huge shock value factor at the beginning, a huge shock value factor at the end. It really reminds me of Rosemary's Baby, which just creeped me out to no end the first time and last time, I might add, that I saw that film. And this story begins from the perspective of the mother giving birth, and it's this fever dream-like aspect there. I didn't look at the text, but it seems like in the narration there's not much punctuation, there's a lot of maybe italics, things like this that Bradbury's adding in. And it's to contribute to this feeling of breathlessness and heat of the moment. And so you eventually realize that it's during the birth that we start out, but you think that you're starting out hearing the voice of a person that's being murdered. And so that twist on the concept of birth and this huge theme of birth and death and mortality in this book as a whole, with a lot of these short stories, it was really shocking to me the first time I read it. And so eventually I did decide to include, of course, this short story because I thought this is the one that had the most impact on me. It was the most frightening, so to speak, so I needed to share it with you guys. These stories, as I mentioned earlier, are really all set in the late 50s. There's a very huge American pastoral, like traditional norms kind of vibes, but I do think that Bradbury takes care to rebel against a lot of the 50s ideals, especially when he's dealing with and talking about women. Especially the concept of women being quiet home bearers. The mother in this story is disturbed because she knows that her baby is evil and she hates the baby. She does not take care of the baby. She's not even attempting to be a good mother and a home bearer. She wants to be an equal partner with her husband. She wants to contribute to a lot of the independent nature and things that are happening in the home. And so I really liked and latched onto the idea of changing the 50s norms around in a book really centered around these norms. There's also a lot of suspense in the same nature that I was talking about earlier in this short story, because you wish for things to progress more quickly, at least I did. And also I wished for things to stick with the mother's perspective. I found her perspective to be wildly interesting at the beginning, but no, they shift to the father's perspective. This father who's very concerned about not only his newborn child, but his wife, and he also has obligations at work, and he's trying to communicate with doctors and all of these things. And so they happen slowly and innocently for the first majority of the story, and then they start to really ramp up at the end. And I felt like this was a really effective way to shift things, because you start hearing the story from a perspective that you identify with. You know, I personally did not identify necessarily with the mother who hates her child, but I was really identifying and understanding the perspective of the father who's concerned about this situation. And I also loved the autobiographical nature of this short story as well. Bradbury talks about his relationship with memory at the beginning of his author's introduction, and this story certainly goes with some of his ideas about birth and what babies are feeling and the nature of babies, for example. The father at the end, before he gets killed, has a monologue about babies resenting their mothers for giving birth to them. We eventually go to the perspective of the doctor that's been with the family this whole time through all these endeavors. At the end, when the doctor realizes, oh my gosh, the baby has killed both of his parents, and they name the baby an apt name. I'm sure you can guess what it is. And I really was shocked and surprised, and I sort of enjoyed this autobiographical touch with this story, where you start to understand the recontextualization of the themes that Bradbury was talking about before we even began the book. Jack in the Box. A boy and his mother in a vast world of a house. What's death? The boy asks. The boy is not allowed to go outside, but is rather expected to enjoy the vastness of the world that his father, whom they call God, created for them. And what's more, the boy is being primed to one day take the position of God himself in their little big world by a mysterious teacher whom everyone but the boy quickly realizes is really his mother in costume. The story ends with his mother dead and the boy in the town beyond his world, laughing and sobbing, "I'm dead! I'm dead! I'm glad I'm dead!" Of course, this story also deals with the very overt themes of birth and death. They get more intense as the short story continues and then fade off a little bit at the end, using really topical symbols as a strategy that Bradbury employs throughout this short story collection, and those topical symbols are focal points of a lot of the stories. For example, the jack-in-the-box in this story is the boy's toy, his main toy, and he eventually chucks it off the side of this huge world-like house, and the jack-in-the-box, of course, breaks, and it breaks open, and it breaks free, and it's damaged, but it's free. And that is the state that the boy ends up in at the end of the story as well. This is the same in the skeleton, very topical idea here. There's a diagram of a skeleton that the man is looking at that he gets from NUDN the whole time. The mummies, of course, the scythe, which we'll get to. Some of the things that this story also has in common with the others, and a few that we are not going to talk about, is taking a common perspective, just like the assassin story, and warping it. Looking at it from a different angle, this is such an amazing skill that Bradbury has, I think also with Fahrenheit 451 here, and it happens with another story in this collection, which we won't talk about, called The Crowd, which is a story about this man who gets into a car accident and he realizes there's a crowd there after like 10 seconds, and the crowd is the same crowd in every accident in the area. Throughout history, so throughout many, many, many years, and he's wondering, who are these people? And he eventually joins the crowd at the end. And I think part of that chilling nature of a lot of Bradbury's writing, I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm glad I'm dead, is attributed to taking these perspectives of the boy really doesn't understand death, but he's thinking that death is something that's good and something that's charitable and something that causes freedom and allows him more movement within his life, and really taking those ideas and running with them. The Scythe. This short story is the treasure trove of themes for the entire book. A starving family of four runs out of gas in front of an abandoned farmhouse way out in the country. They go into the house and find a newly dead farmer in his grave clothes with a scythe next to him that has an engraving on it. "Who wields me, wields the world." The dead farmer has left the farm and goods to whomever finds it, so the family take up a prosperous residence for a time. That is until the husband starts hearing screams in the grain as he's cutting it with the scythe and feeling the souls wither with the dying wheat. He comes across his mother's grain stalk, then his wife, and then his children's, and cuts them, ceaselessly working, ceaselessly working. An amazing part of this story is understanding the concept in the writing of what is knowable within the frame and the realm of the story, which is a really important theme in general for a writer who is able to craft such different worlds throughout the course of a single collection. And there's a lot of balances here that have to be struck as well, because we're looking at what is knowable to the author themselves as they're crafting this world, crafting this story, what is knowable to the central character, perhaps to the narrator then, but also what is knowable to the reader. In The Jack in the Box, the reader ends up knowing and realizing much more than the boy because the boy has a perspective that really narrows his ability to deduce and infer. Whereas in this story, The Scythe, it seems like the main character is coming to conclusions before the readers. And so Bradbury is playing with this concept of what is noble in a really interesting and a really masterful way that really crafts the way that the reader comes across the story as we keep going through. Of course, the themes of mortality, life and death are the most overt here. We have thousands and thousands of people dying. There is a little breakdown, I guess, that the main man has when he's working in the field, and he just stops eating and sleeping and he starts working in the field day and night, just obliterating entire populations of people, and that is the explanation for the atomic bomb at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and all of these horrible, tragic events that are happening around this time that Bradbury is deciding to feature in this book. Another theme is isolation, and this is a huge theme in the other, especially the earlier stories that we looked at in this podcast, Skeleton, Next in Line. Those two characters are extremely isolated from their spouses, from even the reader in some ways. And not only are they isolated in terms of their settings, so we have the one example with the woman who's not in her homeland, she's not even speaking the language of the people around her, and Skeleton isolated from a lot of people in terms of his location. He's just working and at home, working at home. He's isolating himself in that way, but also in terms of their knowledge and their individual burdens. So in this story, The Scythe, the farmer, the main man that we have, has an incredible burden of knowledge that he shares, or at least attempts to share, with his wife and children before they die, but ultimately he ends up bearing that knowledge and that truth alone. And it's the same in the other stories as well. There's also a lot of brilliant contrast being woven into these stories. In terms of this particular short story, there's a contrast between the idyllic setting of a farm and these weird wheat fields with all these beautiful patterns woven in and out of them. This situation that at first seemed really beautiful and really calming and like expensive good luck, so to speak, and then the terrible burden of that this main father figure has to bear. Alright, before we get into the last section of today's episode, I'll give you a chance to grab a new cup of tea, new cup of coffee, and get those jitters under control. I clearly have an unabridged, childish excitement for Halloween. That is why we do such a blown-up, horrifying classic series every single year. But you know what else I love? Extending Horrifying Classics to our Patreon page, where we will be reading an extra spooktastic book for our October Patreon-only podcast. Signing up at patreon.com/relevanceofliterature is an inexpensive and simple way to ensure that the show continues to take flight like a bat, because Halloween is near. See you all on Patreon. Programming. A quick note on something that I find critical for a short story collection, which is programming. There's a source in the description for tips and tricks regarding programming a short story collection, so check it out if you want more info beyond what the organization of our episode today illuminates about the evolution and progression of the novel. Crafting an effective ending. The Wonderful Death of Dudley Stone. Revered author Dudley Stone hasn't written a thing since the book just before he reached his prime, because of an incident where his rival threatened to kill him because he was a better writer than the rival. The deal? That Stone would never put pen to paper ever, ever again. I was so surprised at how quiet this last story was. There was no overt horror element of it. I'm sure the deal where they are working together and striking this thing of life versus death, writing versus not writing, that's a little bit intense, but it wasn't intense in the sense of this theme of, oh my gosh, someone has just died and they're gonna put them in the cage with the mummies. No, it was so regular and realistic and familiar, at least to me as a reader. But he also, as I mentioned in the very beginning in this episode, starts with a writer and ends with a writer. And I am so pleased, or I was so pleased to find that the horror of this story and the tragedy of it is that this story is about a writer who's no longer writing. And again, this plays on the autobiographical aspects of this whole entire collection. It's almost like the death of this writer is a happy one. The perspective is also really interesting, and we've talked about how Bradbury plays with perspective throughout the entire piece. But it's different because here we have someone from the outside, someone who's a fan of this writer's works, looking in on the story and visiting him and asking what happened. It's a little bit more impersonal than the other stories in that way because we're not really following the motivation of the main character as much. It's sort of a story within a story, a frame narration, if you will. I also found that an aspect of this ending in particular that was really effective for me was that it matched the intensity of the other stories in terms of subject matter and in terms of creating this like Spannung, this like amazing spinning thing within the plot, without having the plot give everything away within itself. This story is not a story that you look at for the brilliance of the plot necessarily. It's a story you look at in terms of the context of the whole piece because it stands out so much from the others. There isn't anything overtly twisted within the plot or the characters that makes you think, oh wow, this is an amazing example of Gothic horror or American Gothic. No, this something that it's quieter and it's more normal than the others, but I thought that was so effective for what Bradbury was trying to do. So he ends with this conclusion that really fades into silence, and you're left sitting in that silence at the end of the book, thinking and thinking and thinking, not only about the last story and how the last story is just this perfect, beautiful ending, but also about the collection as a whole, the progression that you've been on. If you read the audiobook version with the reader and the reader looking and performing this book, or if you're reading this book by yourself, just with the text on the page, you're sitting with this text and you're wondering, wow, these words, these techniques, these different characteristics of language that he's using, how did they come to craft such an effective, such a diverse and dynamic look at the American Gothic genre? All right, I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Next time, we are going to look at The Crucible by Arthur Miller. It will be one of the few plays we've ever done on the show, but certainly an important one when we're considering horrifying classics. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.